Pangding, or Dartsado in Tibetan, is perched on the eastern edge of the Tibetan Plateau and has long been a melting pot of Chinese and Tibetan cultural influences. It harvests hydropower from rivers cascading off the plateau. The landslide cut roads, felled power lines, and blocked a river, which then swelled into a lake. The Civil Affairs Ministry said several dozen local residents were evacuated from the area. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Also in China, rescuers are trying to reach 23 coal miners trapped by flooding that were stranded underground early this morning. One miner escaped. Torrential rains have triggered floods and landslides in southern Japan. Officials say 8 people have been killed, including 5 elderly residents of a nursing home. 9 other people are missing. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org.
How is the recession affecting your community? Thursday night at 7, WILL and its community partners are hosting public conversations about the economy in Danville and in Rantoul. For location information, visit willconnect.org/economy or call 217-333-7300. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back on the program once again Michael Ward. He is coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program and visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. And we will be talking this morning about birds, something that we like to do every once in a while just for fun and to encourage people to engage their curiosity and to talk about birds and birds that they have seen. Maybe people have questions about things they can do to welcome more birds into their yard, into their home environment. Questions on any and all of that certainly would be welcome. We'll talk a little bit about some of the research that he's involved in and just answer as many questions as we possibly can. Questions are welcome. The number, if we've got folks here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line, and that would be good for anybody if it would be a long-distance call. Use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you.
We talked, I imagine we must have talked when you were here last a little bit about this major survey of birds that you're involved in and trying to get a sense of how many birds there are, what species there are, and perhaps also how over time that has changed. You're still in the process of collecting this data?
Yes. We finished up all the data collection, but we're still working on analyzing some of the data. And it's really been interesting because the more data and the more analysis we do, the more kind of stories pop up. Right now, we have been looking at why certain birds like Northern Cardinal went in. This survey was started in 1907 by researchers here on campus, and they just went and walked across the landscape and recorded all birds they saw as they walked across the landscape. So it was really the first systematic study of birds in this hemisphere. And so in 1907, there was a lot of birds that we see, you know, walk out of the studio here, walk out anywhere in central Illinois or northern Illinois, and you see cardinals, red-bellied woodpeckers, turkey vultures. In 1907, they were restricted to the southern tip of Illinois. And so trying to figure out, you know, what came about that allowed them to expand their range across to Illinois. Hmm. So that's been interesting. We're still trying to figure that out. You know, it's probably a combination of some mild winters, bird feeders. A lot of the birds that have expanded are bird-feeding birds. And so that's probably all coming together to kind of help some birds expand. One of the other interesting analyses we've been doing the last couple weeks is looking at the trends through time. And some of these birds showed a pretty good dip in the 1950s. So birds that are really common, like red-winged blackbird, has been the most common bird in Illinois in 1907. It was the most common bird in 57. It's going to be the most common bird today. But in the 50s, it showed a dip in abundance that was kind of surprising to us. And then we started going through other species, and we saw this dip in chipping sparrows, grackles, brown-eyed cowbirds. And so what we think is going on is you know, in the 50s is when a lot of the synthetic pesticides and herbicides really got put on the landscape. And also it was a time when there was a lot of persecution on some of these birds that roost communally. So roaming blackbirds had these huge roosts, millions of birds roost down in Louisiana. And, you know, they were agricultural pests, and so they would just take dynamite and blow up these roosts. And so that might explain, because only a certain – the species that we're seeing this kind of dip in are all these species that might be affected by this. So we're looking at long-term kind of changes. Certain birds are going up. Horned larks are going up. Robins are going way up. But other birds are – we're quite concerned about shrikes, bobwhite, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the questions I'm sure concerns people has to do with diversity. And people might say, well, you know, I see birds all the time. There are birds all over the place. There are birds in my backyard. And I'm sure that people do see a lot of sparrows, and they probably see grackles. And, yes, they see robins. And maybe also they see cardinals and they see doves and then, you know, I mean, some other sorts of things. But there really is some reason to be concerned about maybe particular kinds of birds and the total diversity of birds.
Exactly. In urban areas, we're seeing actually an increase in diversity. And so for most people that are living in urban areas, you might not notice this stark change. The dramatic change has been in more rural areas, more agricultural environments where we don't have as much pasture in Illinois anymore, as much small grains, as mainly corn and soybeans, which doesn't really promote a lot of birds. And the second really subtle things are hedgerows. So a lot of the birds that have completely dropped off really don't need much. They just need hedgerows. And we really don't have these hedgerows across the landscape anymore. And we are doing landscape-level approaches using some GIS tools and looking at aerial photos and seeing what's going on. And areas that still have some hedgerows, like southeast Illinois, some areas in southern Illinois, still have these birds. You come up to areas where the hedgerows were knocked out in the 50s up, you know, more central Illinois, northern Illinois. That's where these birds are dropping out. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, a lot of these birds are still relatively common. Field sparrows, brown thrashers, you can see these in your backyard. You can see them at Meadowbrook Park or other preserves around here. But if you look at the trajectory, it's not good. 20 years from now, they're going to be a species we're going to be talking about putting them on a threatened endangered list. And this is the time to figure out why they're declining and stop this when it's much easier. When they get to low populations, it's much harder to restore these populations. So trying to be proactive. Mm-hmm.
One aspect that I think was particularly interesting, you just talked just a little bit about it before we got going, is that one of the things that you've been doing to try to do, your, in a sense, do your count, rather than relying on people going out and looking and saying, all right, there I see a cardinal and there I see a sparrow and writing that down, is what you've done is you've put out recording equipment. What you're doing is you're recording the sounds and then using that as the basis for your count.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is exciting to me. As a researcher and as a bird watcher, I go out and I think I see all the birds that are out there. You know, after you do it for so many years, you kind of get cocky. I'm like, I'm seeing them all. But we know that's not true. And they actually took the best bird watchers, best field people pretty much in the nation that work out in Patuxent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife and did a test in a North Carolina forest in the middle of winter where there wasn't any birds calling. And they put up speakers at different distances from the people, at different heights, facing different directions. And they had the best of the best write down what they heard. And there's only 12 species. And it was really sobering, and they did a very poor job. And if these are the best of the best, and they're doing a poor job, what are, you know, people that don't have as much experience doing? And so we're lucky here on campus that, you know, we had this problem, and we're able to go work with NCSA, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and some professors over at ECE, the Electrical and Computer Engineering, who, you know, because we didn't have a lot of funds to actually help them out initially, but kindness of their heart, they started working with us and developing some of the tools that we really need to record these birds. Because the first problem is you just can't buy stuff off the shelf because all the recording equipment and equipment to send signals across is for human voice, which doesn't get high enough in frequency. And since birds are singing at very high frequencies, there's just not stuff off the shelf you can buy. So we had to develop everything from scratch. Mm-hmm. So we developed this stuff, and then you get, you know, gigabytes and terabytes of data. Well, as an ecologist, we don't used to dealing with that much data. And so NCSA comes in and where we can give them the data, they can manipulate the data and then run through algorithms, automated learning programs to learn, all right, this is a wren, this is a robin, you know, this is a black-throated green warbler. And, you know, we're not to the point yet where we're going to, you know, deploying these everywhere, but we're actually this morning I was out playing with this, trying to get it down perfect. And we're making good progress. And, you know, we're talking about this survey. I imagine in 20 years when they do the survey again, it won't be humans listening. Humans will be going out there and putting down devices to listen, and then coming back and analyzing it. So,
well, I'm just curious now for a second, and I've got a caller here when I get to you, but going back to the experiment that they did where they took people who were really supposed to be just the best birders and took them out and they just played the songs and they said, okay, you tell us what you hear. Is it that they were saying that they couldn't identify what they were, or they were saying that it was one bird when it was another bird?
Yeah. So, no one ever says they can't identify the bird. It's just a, you know, it's just a cocky thing. But the if birds are playing at the same time, you know, humans tend to focus on one species. And so certain people would hear a bird and not hear the other bird. And it was a human bias. So some of the people were picking up Perua warblers. Others were picking up black-throated greens. And they were singing at the same time. And just kind of human nature is you kind of focus on birds you like. Also the distance. Some people, their hearing just isn't good and they can't hear stuff as far away. And we have really no good way of controlling for that right now. We try to do that in some of our analysis, but it's difficult.
Yeah, and that points for people who are interested in birds, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, that you don't often see it, or maybe you don't get a real good view, and so that you really have to know what the song is to know what the bird is.
Yeah, it's all song these days. You know, most species are just difficult to see, and you can't rely on that. So it's all by ear, and obviously, there's variation in people's ears. So.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Michael Ward. He's a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about birds. And if you have bird questions, you can call us, and he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's somebody over in Danville, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'd like to ask about a particular device that I've seen advertised in birding magazines, and it involves a barcode in which with pictures of the birds, in which you can just play the bird's song by putting a wand over this thing. Have you had experience with it, and are they pretty good representations of the song?
There's some good products out there where they, I think even iPhones has an application for this as well, where if you want to play a song of a bird out in the field, you just, you know, there's different ways of doing it. It'll broadcast the song. Usually the song is recorded at high fidelity, so it's the correct frequencies are there. The problem that a lot of people run into is that when you the speaker you buy to play it, a lot of speakers are designed to put, you know, for human voice or for human songs. And generally speaking, they don't have the fidelity across the whole, all the frequencies in which birds sing. So sometimes you have really high-pitched birds, and you play that song, and it just sounds really bad to us, and it even sounds worse to the birds. So I think that the products and the MP3s or the WAV files, whatever they give you to play, are good. It's just making sure you have a good speaker in which to play it on, or the birds are going to hear that and think, well, that's not one of my buddies, or they're going to hear it and think, that bird's sick, and not, you know, go the other way, so...
I see. Well, the main reason I called was because when we built this house in the mid-60s, there wasn't a tree on the lot. And I wondered if even our first spindly trees that we put out, I wondered if even a bird would land in, much less nest in. But over the 40 years or so, we've been planting more and more things that birds like. And I have now recorded 107 species seen in or above my yard. I have been keeping track. I've made a chart and kept track of what I saw every day for about 10 years. And I'm about to throw away those charts, and I just wondered if anyone would be interested in having them.
Yeah. Couple things here. So first off, I think that your experience is pretty common. That when we look at these long-term trends, a lot of important areas in Illinois for birds are urban areas, where people are putting a lot of trees in their back 40, and they're getting a lot of birds in those areas. So that's great. In terms of your records, there is a Cornell has a program called eBird, which I'm sure you can find just by Googling it, just E and then bird.
I don't use a computer.
Oh. You might be able to contact them via the phone as well, but they have a network now where they're taking all of kind of amateur and professional bird records and putting in a database. So the idea is they can use all this data to kind of get an idea of, you know, when West Nile comes in and
yes, I'm
grows.
Aware of the Cornell program. I just thought there might be someone in Illinois that would be interested in the local trend right. of birds seen in urban areas.
Yeah. Well, what I'm doing personally is we're using Cornell. So since Cornell's got the infrastructure and we're trying to have a common kind of database where everything's kept the same way in the same place. So even though it might go out to New York, we would have access to it. And you know, I hope to use that quite a bit as they get it up and going. So.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. And that is there's lots of birding information and resources on the web for people who do have access. But Cornell, certainly it's well known as a place for the study of birds. And they have really nice material there. If you're interested in a bird, you can put the name in there. They'll show you what it looks like. There's a thing you can click on and it will play you the song, which my cat finds very interesting. And so that's one place if you're interested in getting just a thumbnail sketch about birds and what they look like and what they sound like. That's a pretty good place to go.
Yep. Yeah.
And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We're inviting questions about birds here. And our guest is Mike Ward. He is a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at University of Illinois. I was interested in maybe having you talk a little bit more, or maybe you could say something about how, and I guess, again, before we got going, you mentioned one thing we could talk about that has to do with birds, southern wetland birds showing up here, and that has to do with the fact that where they usually live, it's been really dry, so there isn't the territory that they're looking for, so they're coming in and finding places to roost here. That just maybe says something about climate and how certainly over the short term it can affect the birds that you see. I'm kind of wondering about, you know, whether you've seen any kind of long-term trends.
Yeah, so I mean that's interesting from both research perspective and from birdwatching perspective. So right now we're seeing both short and long term trends for wetland birds. So on the short term, there are white ibises. I guess there's four of them down by St. Louis. There's at least four brown pelicans in Illinois. There's roseate spoonbills in Indiana, and these are all birds that traditionally only breed along the Gulf Coast. Just this morning on my way into work in St. Joe Wetland, there was a little blue heron, which, you know, might have nested down by St. Louis, but it also could have nested, you know, in Texas. And so Texas is experiencing a large drought along the coast along with Louisiana. And so you start seeing these birds going north and farther north. We had such a wet spring that we still have a lot of fields and a lot of areas along rivers that are very flooded and are great habitat for birds. And so on the short term, you see all these birds pop up. On the long term, because we're restoring more habitat in Illinois and the Midwest, and because DDT is kind of dropping out of the – is less prevalent in our systems, you're seeing increases in egrets, herons, night herons, cormorants, all these wetland birds that, you know, 20 years ago were south of here for a couple different reasons. Now we restored the habitat. We have cleaner environments. Bald eagles are now coming back. And so over the long term, we're seeing, you know, a slow progression north of some of the wetland birds. And over the short term, you get, you know – it's unlikely the white ibis are going to be established breeders in Illinois, but it's exciting to see that they can move that quickly. And what we see in our backyard today is, you know, is dictated by what happens, you know, 500 miles away in Texas or what have you. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got some other callers here. Let's see. Williamsport, Indiana is the next, and that's line number one.
Hi. Hello. Good morning. Thank you. In regards to the last caller in Danville, Illinois, she might want to go to the Danville Public Library and speak to a Mary Jane Easterday, who is an avid birder and probably could help her getting her information to the Cornell University. Or she could also contact Marilyn Campbell, who used to be with the Illinois Audubon Society. And Marilyn, I think, is listed in the phone book. She lives in Georgetown, Illinois.
Yep, those are great ideas. Both those are avid birders, and I'm sure they both have access. I know Marilyn would have access to get those records to Cornell.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go over to Belgium for the next call. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. And good morning to you all. First, I have a couple of different items, but the first item is the one bird that I've noticed disappear a whole lot from around is quail. We don't seem to – I used to see lots of quail and little chicks running along behind them a lot, and you just don't hardly see them at all anymore. And that must definitely be, according to what you said, a lot of the – hedgerows are gone and stuff like that. The other thing I wanted to point out is if people ever happen to travel, there happens to be a fabulous place to go birding just north of San Francisco on the Point Reyes seashore, a place called Bolinas. You can't find Bolinas very easily because the people who live there keep tearing down the signs, so you can't go there. But they have a bird sanctuary there that you'll hear more birds and see more birds than you've ever seen in your life because they're right on a flyway, the Pacific Flyway there. It's just phenomenal, the number of birds you can see there. And that was the two items I was going to talk about.
Okay. Yeah, very good. You're definitely correct about the Bob White. So this long-term study we're doing from 1907 to currently. In 1907, we do some analysis called occupancy analysis. So it's the probability if you walk across a field, you're going to scare up a bird. So in 1907, you had a 100% chance in Southern Illinois of scaring up a Bob White. Now you have a 40% chance in Southern Illinois. In Central Illinois, you had about an 80% chance in 1907. Now that's down to 15% chance. We're really losing these because of the hedgerows and just small little shrubby areas that they need. I was just out over in western Illinois, Mason, Tazewell counties, doing some surveys, and they have a little bit more shrubbiness because there's some new USDA programs out there, new CRP, a new program called SAFE, that gets some more grassland, some more shrubbiness on the landscape. And it doesn't take much. So over there, they have irrigation fields. They're irrigating their crops. And so obviously the irrigation is circle because they have this pivot irrigation. And so the fields are square. And so you have all these little corners, four corners, where they can't really farm. And so they're putting in, and these are small, you know, 4, 5, 6 acres areas. They're just putting grass in there. And it's amazing how many Bob White have responded to just a little bit of habitat on the landscape. So, you know, I hope that's the future and that we have kind of progressive programs to try to get just little bits of habitat. I think it's going to work real well for quail. I'm not so sure it'll work real well for pheasants. Pheasants tend to need a little bigger areas, it seems like. But for quail, I think just getting a little bit out there can really go do a lot for these populations because, as I mentioned, you know, right now we're at 15% chance, you know, and the way it's going, we're going to be down to, you know, zero before long. So,
the area you went to over there in Mason County, would that be Chautauqua?
It's not very far from Chautauqua, Manitou area, Pekin area.
Yes.
And Chautauqua is a great birding
yes.
area for wetland areas, but we were more out in the agricultural areas.
The Chautauqua area is very nice for that. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll go to another caller here. This is Atlanta, Illinois, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my question. I just had a question about a specific bird that we've seen at our feeder for years, and all of a sudden it seems to disappear. I just wanted to know if you have an idea this is a general thing or specific to our habitat. It's a tufted titmouse.
Yeah, so tufted titmouse are generally holding their own in Illinois, but I know Atlanta, so it's I know around my house that we're right on the cusp of where a rough winter or stuff, they'll start moving around. And so if you go south of where we're at right now, they're pretty steady populations. Right around here, you start getting some rough winters, they'll start moving around a little bit, and so they might be gone for a couple years. They're also a species that in winter really likes to be in oaks, the oaks that produce acorns. And so some of our oaks are, well, we're losing some oaks, and the oaks we have tend not to produce as many acorns anymore. So if you're near a forest that and oaks in a cycle where some years are producing a lot of acorns, other years are not. So I wouldn't be alarmed. It's probably one of these short-term phenomenons where they're probably gone for a while, and hopefully they'll pop back in eventually.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're inviting your questions on birds this morning here in this hour of Focus 580, and our guest is Michael Ward. He's a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the U of I. The caller from Belgium talked about a particular place out in California that was great to see birds. We have three major flyways here in the United States, one on each coast and one in the middle. We got this river called the Mississippi. So they kind of tend to, right. to go up sort of the middle. So what are some great places in the state of Illinois to go?
The last car talked about Chautauqua. So the Illinois River Valley from Peoria down to Meredosia area. You know, I grew up over there. And historically, I go out when I was younger, there wasn't a lot of habitat there. Now, you can't get away from habitat. There's so much habitat you can't even cover it all. And so the Nature Conservancy, IDNR, Fish and Wildlife Service has all come together to purchase large amounts of area in this floodplain and create great wetland habitat. And especially for people just kind of novices to birders or people just getting kind of getting into and enjoying birds, wetland birds are great because they're big, they're obvious, they're easy to identify. But if you want a little more challenge, there's shorebirds that come through. So this is a perfect time of year. We're right at the beginning of when a lot of birds that bred up in the Arctic Circle are starting to think, well, you know, starting to get a little colder up here. I'm going to start heading south. And so shorebirds are just coming through. The first started coming through last week. Around here in Champaign County and in the eastern Illinois, flooded fields. So there's still some flooded fields down in Arcola area in southern Champaign County. Those flooded fields are important stopover habitat. So we have the big refuges like over in Danville has Kickapoo and Kennecuck County Park. You have the Illinois River Valley. Southern Illinois is, you can go down that way. The Cache River area is just great with the cypress tupelo swamps, lots of breeding warblers, lots of both grassland birds, shrubland birds. So there's lots of areas out there. There's lots of resources out there as well. Several books are out now on where to go birdwatching in Illinois. There's lots of areas in the Chicagoland area as well. So there's plenty, and it's pretty easy to find out where to get to. And there's close in Meadowbrook Park, even in here in Champaign. Walking out there in the morning, it's amazing what you see fly over out there.
Yeah, okay. We have a caller in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was just curious if you could shed any light on a wild little parakeet that comes around our place, and especially likes it if I take my caged parakeet outside. And he has the guest parakeet actually visits with it, and they seem to have a pleasant time, and it will suddenly fly off. Is this pretty unusual? I mean, I'm assuming it's was someone's pet who escaped, or do these kinds of birds find homes around here?
So it is a bit unusual, though we do hear about it. Just a couple weeks ago, someone mentioned something to me about one. They won't make it through the winter, so that's the thing. I mean, right now they'll be fine. They'll go out. They can find some seeds, but they won't make it through winter. The only parakeets in Illinois that can make it through winter are – there's a population of monk parakeets in Chicago, mm-hmm. and they are on the south side of Chicago, and they only make it through winter because there's a series of bird feeders, people that put out huge smorgasbords of food for them, uh-huh. and that's the only way they can make it through the winter. So so we do hear every year we get a couple calls about a cockatiel or a parakeet in someone's backyard, but it's definitely an escapee. And unless somebody takes it in, it's not going to make it through the winter.
Would you advise trying to take it in?
Sure. I mean, yeah, okay. I think for the bird, obviously, that's the only solution it's going to really have in the long term. I know with the monk parakeets, occasionally we get calls from USDA or others that, because some of these parakeets can be agricultural pests where they're native, like in Argentina. Mm-hmm. But again, in Illinois, the winters, unless global climate change really changes our winters a lot, I don't think there's really much potential for these birds establishing viable populations without human assistance.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll try to catch it.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
We have somebody here who had a question that they asked off the air. They wanted to know, could you say something about the local purple martins population?
Yeah. Purple martins aren't doing very well. As you go farther south, they're doing better. You look at the long-term trends of purple martins, it's pretty poor. There is a few people that have well-established purple martin houses that still have some populations. I personally tried to get some purple martins back into St. Joe and had some difficulty getting them there. We know they're declining. We don't know why. There's two potential reasons. One is they like other species, but more they have bigger roosts than other species. They come together in winter and they create these enormous roosts down in Atlanta, on the Gulf Coast, and even farther south. And sometimes these roosts are in areas where people get kind of upset, and so they get persecuted a little bit. And so you might lose some population by trying to get them out of these residential areas. The other thing is, generally speaking, a lot of the birds that like to eat moths and bigger-sized insects are really doing poorly. And we don't have a lot of data on this, but it could be that, you know, like nighthawks, whippoorwills, pearl martins, these aerial insectivores that like moths or small moths, big moths, or whatever, it could be the moth population is dropping. There's some evidence out there the moth population is dropping. You know, a lot of the what we spray for agricultural pests might impact some of the moths. And so that could explain why we see pearl martins, whippoorwills, and common nighthawks, all birds that need these, all declining simultaneously across Illinois.
Okay. Let's go on here. Champagne is next, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My question is actually somewhat related in terms of chemical usage. As far as you're aware, is contemporary suburban commercial lawn care spraying that you just see around town. Is that affecting bird populations significantly?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of data on this, but my general feeling is it's not a huge impact. If you look at birds in urban areas, they tend to be increasing. It could be that we're kind of biased in that because it's been going on so long, the birds that are here and increasing just are used to it, and the birds that couldn't handle some of this applications of different pesticides, winked out a while back. But generally speaking, we don't see people bring us in dead birds occasionally, and sometimes it appears that they got poisoned somehow or another. But I think it's for people not following the directions on the whatever applications they're putting on their lawn. I think if you follow the label instructions, as they say, that there's a lot of testing now by EPA, and generally they have very rapid their lives are pretty short. They degrade pretty quickly. And so I don't think it's having a big impact. One of the things we still worry about is once you get out of the United States, some of these really nasty chemicals are still being used on agricultural products in Central and South America and Mexico. And so we worry about DDT and other – because these birds, they're only spending half their lives here in Illinois, so we can do all we can to save these birds. But we really need to think on a broader scale, and, we can put lots of money into saving a certain bird here in, Champaign County, but it's spending its other half of its life in Honduras, and we need to think about, at least providing the resources that government needs to protect those species as well.
Okay. Thanks for your thought on that.
Thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I just thought I would ask you about a bird that we now have around our house, and it seems like it's become kind of established. And before, I don't know, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I don't ever remember having heard it. And that's the catbird, the gray catbird. And I guess the first time I became aware of it was they have this characteristic sort of call that sounds kind of like a cat. That's why they call it that. And then they also have this much more crazy, complicated song that they do. And I think that they're a lovely bird, and it's nice to have them around. But it's funny that I don't – and now in the summertime, it seems like they're around a lot. And I just don't remember – going back maybe like 5-6 years,
right?
Don't remember having heard them.
Yeah, their populations aren't increasing a lot, but they definitely are moving in some urban areas because on our urban, they really like really dense, shrubby kind of habitats that have some fruiting trees like honeysuckle or buckthorn. And a lot of our areas in town, we have problems with invasive species, particularly honeysuckle. And so that's a perfect habitat. And so historically, where they might have been in some hedgerows, they might have been in some other more rural areas, now just moving to town in this dense honeysuckle, there's some evidence that it's kind of what we call an ecological trap, where they come in there thinking this looks great, it's honeysuckle, but there's so many predators in urban areas that they get tricked in thinking, wow, this is great. It's so dense and there's lots of berries. But the reality is, raccoons like that as well, possums like that, skunks, and their nests get eaten. But they're – as opposed to – so catbirds and brown thrashers are both what we call mimics. They're in the same family of birds. And kind of – they both like dense areas. But for some reason, brown thrashers really haven't transitioned into – you will find some in urban areas, but they're not as much of an urban bird as catbirds. And because of that, because a lot of our rural hedgerows and stuff are gone, brown thrashers are going down very quickly. Again, it kind of shows that, this might change too. Some birds, we've seen this with Cooper's hawks. We've seen this with sandhill cranes where, they don't use urban areas. And all of a sudden, a few of them move into urban areas. And it's probably some cultural thing where their buddies see that, these other guys are in an urban area and they're just producing all kinds of young and they quickly move in there. And that's probably what happened with Cooper's hawks where, you can drive any town in Illinois or in the Midwest now, there's Cooper's hawks. And they learned really quickly, let's move in these areas and take it over. So it could be that catbirds have done this, and brown thrashers maybe hopefully will do this in the future to help their populations.
Well, we used to actually – it's a little overgrown, my backyard, and I had a neighbor that was really overgrown. And when we first moved into this house, we actually would see brown thrasher fairly often. Then we had a subsequent owner decided to civilize their backyard.
Yeah.
So we still occasionally see the thrasher, but not as much as we used to.
Yeah, they definitely need more dense area, and they don't like to be disturbed as much as catbirds. Catbirds will sit in their top of your roof and sing their heads off, and brown thrashers tend not to like to do that as much. So
yeah, okay. We are moving into about our last 15 minutes, and we have some callers here, and we'll get back to the phones and talk with someone in Tinley Park. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. I was just calling to say that now I've got a small berm out in my backyard, and this is the first year that I've seen bobwhite. And I was just kind of amazed to see that.
Yeah, so you're up in Tinley Park. So I actually got some reports from people in Southern Cook County saying they actually saw more bobwhite this year than they ever have before up in that area. I attribute that to you know, the Cook County and Will County and other DuPage County getting more landscape out, getting more habitat out there. Their forest preserve districts are doing a good job getting landscape out there, and also they're providing more management. So it's great just to get habitat out there and let it go, but a lot of times you let it go and it turns into honeysuckle and buckthorn messes. But they're actually trying to restore savanna and get these big oaks and shrubby areas, and that's the perfect habitat for bobwhite. And we know there's a pretty good population in Kankakee County and Iroquois County, so I think it's happening. It's they're starting to create this habitat on the southern Chicagoland area, and these birds are starting to disperse north and take advantage of these new habitats.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Like I said, I've got two blue spruce out there, and actually since we've moved out here, I've probably seen more. We had an Arctic owl out here last winter.
Yep.
My neighbor next door had sent me a picture of a pheasant on their front lawn. I mean, it's just kind of bizarre that, you know, these are things that, like somebody was saying earlier, you drive downstate where you expect to see all this open farm field. You expect to see something flush up or come across, and you don't. And then you come into, you know, a semi-rural backyard, and there they are. I mean, it's very, you know, it's nice. It's very rewarding to see them come back. I really like that.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's, you know, again, I think it's the putting the habitat in, out there in these more urban areas. I mean, the problem with that is it's not a real problem with birds is you start getting the issues with deer and coyotes and that kind of stuff. But but I'm a bird person, so I don't have to deal with that. So
right. Well, you know what? I like seeing either one of them. I mean, if I see something that, you know, that's to me got a little reward of saying, hey, you know, you're number one, but don't forget why you're here.
So. Yeah.
All right.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, I think you really touch on something that's really important and people need to think about, and that is, you know, we have a lot of habitat has been lost. And on the other hand, what we've done with our yards, because we like to have mature trees and we like to have shrubs and we like to have things like this, we've made it as much like the other habitat as we could. So suddenly we moved the habitat out in more rural areas. We've made our yards a little bit wilder, so you shouldn't be surprised if a whole range of animals is going to say, well, this is the kind of place where we want to live, and you're going to have maybe not just things that you would like to have, but, you know, possibly some things that you might not like to have.
But yeah, that's from my perspective, that's a great thing about birds. So birds are able to move around so quickly and take advantage of this. So you can buy a house, you know, 10 years, get some nice landscaping back there, and get birds back there. You get vireos and thrushes and stuff nesting in there. You know, the problem is the coyotes and the deer that people don't appreciate as much. And those populations can grow unchecked. And a lot of these bird populations still have checks and balances associated with – they still have predators out there. They still have the Cooper's hawks or whatever is preying on them. So their populations are more balanced. You know, you get the deer in there, you're not getting the wolves in there and stuff like that. So those populations grow unbalanced. But, but you know, there's people are getting a good understanding of that. And there's great, you know, Cook County, all the Chicagoland areas have good biologists that are really trying to tackle that problem.
Other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Lawrence County, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to listen to the first of the program, so you may have addressed this already, but I just had a couple comments on something that I heard you say.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody asked about lawn care and using pesticides, and you said probably a direct death of a bird wouldn't result, but what about the effect of lawn care on killing off insects and food for birds? And the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, you talked about migrating songbirds and how, of course, they depend upon habitat in Central and South America. Do you have any comments on coffee growing practices, shade versus sun-grown coffee, and the effect of that on loss of habitat? So I'll just hang up and listen to your comments on those.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, so that's a very good question about, you know, it might not directly kill the birds, but it reduces their food source. That can be a problem. And I do think you see that. So particularly in areas where the turf grass is really well manicured and there's obviously they're putting a lot of chemicals on there, you do see the lack of some of the species, like some of the flycatchers, the peewees, the phoebes. And so I do think there's maybe an indirect effect where you might not be killing some of these birds, but you put a lot of pesticides on there, you're definitely causing these birds to move to other areas. Or there might be a more direct effect where they can't raise as many young. So, but again, you know, there's not a lot of research on that, but it'd be great to get a better idea what's going on with that. With the shade coffee versus sun coffee, I think from my experience down in Central America and what I've read, you know, shade coffee is the way to go. You know, going to some of these shade coffee plantations, I've been to some in Mexico and Belize and Honduras and such, and they're amazing. I mean, the bird community is pretty much equal to the natural areas in those areas. And you go to the other coffee plantations that aren't shade, they're kind of grown in more of an industrial style, and you lose all those birds. So there's a bunch of really – the ant followers, a lot of the, you know, toucans, trogons, a lot of these birds that you know, need more intact forest. You find them in these shade coffee because they have so much around them. There's a developed understory, there's a developed middle story and a canopy. And again, these full sun kind of industrial coffees are – I mean, they're not – they're kind of equivalent to our cornfields. I mean, there's a couple things there, but they're not nearly like the shade coffee.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest for the show is Michael Ward. He is a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. We're talking about birds, and your questions are welcome. We have a couple people here ready to go. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Urbana and line 2.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. This is a great show. I've been a little concerned about the city parks here in Champaign-Urbana, where they're just going in and cutting down the shrubs. And it's, you know, they've been formerly great birding places, and now they're just kind of denuded banks. And I'm kind of wondering why this is happening, and what can be done about it.
Yeah. So it's a tough question. I don't know if they have gone in, I know, at like Busey Woods and cut out a lot of honeysuckle. And it's definitely a tricky situation because the honeysuckle, there's no question, it reduces the diversity of plant community, and it's it also reduces some of the other herp communities, apparently. For birds, you know, birds respond to structure. And so once you start cutting these out, if no native shrubs come back in, then you're going to lose some of those birds that you want there. And so the real trick, the real hard thing for a lot of these managers is you want to get rid of the honeysuckle and you want to keep it out, but you want to promote the native shrubs. And a lot of native shrubs are a lot less tolerant to deer grazing. It takes them longer to establish. And so I've kind of heard this before, and we've seen this, where you know, it's a good idea to get rid of some, either it's buckthorn or honeysuckle, but once you get rid of it, a lot of times it's more difficult to establish the native shrubs like amulank or hawthorn or stuff like that. And it takes a long time, and so you have this downtime where you really reduce the bird diversity over a short term. And this is one of the things we've been talking with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources about and trying to – because they have the same problem on a lot of their habitats where they have invasive species problems, but those invasive species of plants support some of these important shrubland birds. And we really need to come up with a really good management approach to address the invasive species problem, but also at the same time promote some of these native shrubs to get back quickly so the bird populations don't suffer.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And on to the next caller, and that would be someone in Effingham, line 3. Hello.
Yes, I was just wondering I got like 10 acres of orchard grass, and you know, when you cut it, you always want to cut it the earliest. But for quail population, what would be the latest you can cut it for the hatching and everything else, and so you don't destroy the quail?
Yeah, so it's right about now is what I'd like to see when it's cut a little bit, maybe just a little bit later. Right now, the quail coveys are probably out, and especially if this your acres is surrounded by – if there's other areas they can go to, and if they need – they're still kind of young, they need certain kind of resources. It's Effingham is nice because I know from Effingham to Newton, there's lots of grassland down there, and especially if you're kind of in that area where there's other CRP, other areas around. I think I wouldn't do it much before now if you really want to promote all the grassland birds, not just quail, but all of them. But I think right now the covey should be – it should be about – you should be okay doing it right now.
Just another comment. We got a real good bird sanctuary, Ballard's Nature Center, between Effingham and Altamont. It's like 60 or 80 acres, and it's got all native grass and wetlands and everything else. So
Yeah, I was just down there a couple of days ago at the Preaching Sanctuary giving a talk, and I'm always impressed down there at the Effingham down toward Farina and then over toward Newton about, you know, how many of the farmers actually have a lot of land in USDA programs to get grassland out there. And then Illinois Audubon and IDNR has bought up a lot of grassland. And it's amazing to me. You get off 57 and start driving down these back roads, and there's all kinds of, you know, quail down there and dick thistles and meadowarks and even shrikes, a bird, you know, you can't find north of there. But because people are doing a good job down there getting grass in the landscape, it's good. It's a good area.
Okay, thank you. Right, thank enjoyed you. Your show.
Very good. On again to Carla here. This is Savoy, line four. Hello.
Hello, yes. I have a question. I didn't tune in right away, so perhaps you already answered it. But if you've seen the birds, there seems to be a pretty big problem with certain songbirds from what people refer to as nuisance birds, which are mostly some kind of blackbird species. And it doesn't seem to be any way to help these songbirds. Cardinals come to mind from 20 years ago that populations are vastly diminished. And I just wondered if you had any ideas.
Yeah, I mean, songbirds, some of the songbirds are definitely diminished and some of the songbirds are increasing. And, you know, there is ways to help some of the birds. I mean, songbirds kind of encompasses a lot of different species. And what I kind of like to do is try to break it down by different habitats. So you got the birds that are more urban areas, some of the cardinals and robins, and they're doing pretty well. Forest songbirds, you know, they have some problems. You know, if we shade coffee, promoting that will help them because they tend to winter there. Having bigger forest tracks will help them. What I'm really worried about in terms of like, some of the songbirds are the songbirds that like the grassland, like alfalfa fields. Those are the ones that are just declining. You know, there's some nuisance species we talk about with the blackbirds. They do get some persecution and there's some poisoning. And when that happens, we usually hear about it very quickly. But going back in the records, we've been working on this 100-year bird thing and going back in the records, it doesn't seem to be a drop in the bucket compared to what was happening in the 50s with some of the ways they would get rid of nuisance birds. So I'm not too worried about persecution of nuisance birds. I'm more worried about getting some of the habitats back out there on the landscape for some of these shrubland and grassland birds.
Right. You know, one other quick thing is I have red-winged blackbirds eating out of my bird feeder for the past 3 years, and I've lived in the country forever. I've never known that to happen, and I can only figure that the bugs and stuff they normally get at the sides of fields must be, like, hardly there.
Yeah, that could be it. I think the other equation to this is that I'm getting red-wings in my feeder, too, in town. I think they're starting to learn that especially sunflower seed is so valuable to them in terms of the oils and fats in them that they learn that they're not getting persecuted anymore. So there's probably some natural selection years ago when a lot of these were persecuted that you just stay as far away from people as you can. And now through time that, you know, either it's natural selection or cultural learning, they've learned that, you know, if I go to someone's backyard, I'm not going to get shot anymore. So they're starting to show up more in people's backyard because sunflower seed is, you know, not quite as good for their young. It's not as good for their young as insects, but for the adults, you know, there's the difference isn't that much between insects and sunflower seeds, and it's probably a lot easier to pick up sunflower seeds and search around for insects. So,
right, okay, thanks so much.
All right, very good. One more caller here, at least here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. A few years ago, we had a family of wild turkeys, and I quite enjoyed them. They were in my neighborhood. Did people really have to be afraid of them so that they had to be chased out? I mean, I would walk right up to them.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's one of the tough ones as well. Again, kind of going by this argument of, you know, we want more natural areas around us. That happens, and, you know, some of these birds can be problems. Turkeys, you know, aren't going to – they're going to really scare people. They're going to come up flying at you. They can't hurt you. They have some spurs on their legs. They can't hurt you. It was probably best that – I know that APHIS came in, the USDA APHIS, and came in and removed them. Their long-term – survive, you know, for ground nesting birds, especially like turkeys in urban areas, the long term for them in these areas isn't very good. Just because their nests on the ground are going to be eaten by all kinds of different things. Their young are going to be easy pickings because they're precocial young, so they're running around and they're going to be young and can't fly for a month almost. And so they're going to be really easy pickings for cats. So I think dissuading, not establishing turkey populations in urban areas is probably better for the turkeys and for the humans. So.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. I was wondering, I guess when the earlier caller was talking about problems with songbirds, I started thinking about the brown-headed cowbird and just about other birds that prey on the birds and whether that is a particular problem, how much of a problem that is. And, you know, for example, with the cowbird, I'm not exactly sure what can be done about that.
Yeah, the cowbird's tricky. So the cowbird lays its eggs in other birds' nests, and the other birds raise its young. In some areas, they have full-time people. That's all they do is kill cowbirds, like in Texas and Michigan. And that works on very small, local areas. And they're doing that to preserve species that are right at the brink of extinction. Mm-hmm. In Illinois, you know, cowbirds are definitely a problem with forest birds primarily, but other species as well. But with forests, they don't like – they like small forests, areas they can kind of get in, get out quick, go out in the ag and forage and get back in. So the solution for that is getting – creating bigger and bigger forests. And we tend to be doing that down in southern Illinois, trying to – reforest some of these inholdings, some of the areas where we used to try to farm, the farming wasn't very productive, and we're trying to get forests back in there. We have some other research that's interesting over in Kennecuck right now, where we're putting cameras on birds' nests and seeing what's eating the babies. And lo and behold, one of the predators was cowbirds flying in, killing young birds. Just, you know, they're not eating them, they're just killing them. Mm-hmm. And so that causes the parents to re-nest, and then they can put their eggs in the parents' nest, because if they put the egg in with young birds, that egg wouldn't hatch. And so they're crafty birds, and they're a problem. It turns out the main predator over in Kennecuck was snakes. But we also had squirrels eating the young out of nests, which you don't – these little cute little squirrels come into the video camera and think, oh, that's kind of cute. Next thing you know, they're ripping the heads off all the young birds.
That's what I wouldn't think that a squirrel would – I don't think of a squirrel in that that way.
It's pretty gory. They're ripping their heads off and sucking out whatever they can. It's the squirrels can be pretty tough. So and then we have raccoons, but – well, most of it's snakes, which was surprising to us because you don't see very many snakes on the landscape anymore. Yeah. But we're putting transmitters in snakes, and you know, maybe next time if I come on, we'll have the data and I can talk about how far these snakes move around and how they actually find all these nests. Because that's, you know, it's hard for us to find nests. How are they finding all these nests? Because the idea is that snakes don't move that much; they kind of hang out and, you know, sun themselves. But yeah. I think that we're finding that that's not maybe the truth.
Well, that's another a thing that I'm sure that people don't really think about, those men being in the environment. Occasionally, in my backyard, I see them, and the thing is that they're there and they're kind of hiding out. And the only time that you see is if you spook them, and then they say, "Well, I'm going to get out of here."
Yeah.
And the ones that I see are not terribly big, like maybe about as big around as a pencil, or maybe a little bit bigger than that.
Yeah, those aren't problems. The ones we're getting over at Kennecuck are, we don't put a transmitter in them unless they're 3-4 foot long. And so these are good sized snakes.
These are good sized
snakes. They're the ones that I got brave field assistants that will see them and dive on them and grab them, and so we can put the transmitter on them. I don't particularly like doing that. But these are big snakes. And, you know, I don't think snakes are bad. It's just that we got to understand, you know, how we manage the landscape and how that promotes snake populations and how snakes find those nests. And is there a way that we can make the nests, you know, bigger areas so the snakes don't find as many nests or what have you. So,
well, there we'll have to leave her this time around. Our guest is Mike Ward. He is a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. He's also coordinator of the Critical Trends Assessment Program here at the U of I. And every once in a while, if he's got the time, he'll come on and talk about birds. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're broadcasting from Kemble Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni, Alice and Robert Campbell. We'll break for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Asgrow's new Roundup Ready 2-yield soybeans. Lernard Seed Service provides services to help customers in East Central Illinois maximize profits. 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. Let's go right out to the pits where both corn and soybeans are putting in strong days to the upside today. Let's look at the particulars. We'll begin in the corn pit of the Chicago Board of Trade, where September corn is now 321¾, up 13¾. December, 333, up 13¾. March of 2010, 346¼, up 13½. September crude oil's at 66.92, up 152. While the August RBOB's at 190.8 cents, up 7 cents. August beans, 10.28, up 9½. September, 9.63¼, up 18¼. November, 9.30¼, up 22½. Now at 9.30½. August soybean meal, 3/23/50 up 250. August soybean oil at 34.71 up 19. September corn at the Board of Trade is at 5/24 1/4 up 2 1/4.